Welcome to Defining the Future, the podcast that celebrates the ideas, innovations and people making the world a better place. I'm Claire Rutherford, a patent attorney and founder of Definition IP. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Daniel Stewart. Daniel is the CEO and co-founder of Viridi CO2. After his PhD alongside Professor Robert Raja, the pair co-founded Viridi CO2, an innovation-driven scale-up enabling chemical manufacturers to transform their waste CO2 into high-value chemicals. Viridi CO2 technology takes carbon dioxide that would otherwise be released into the atmosphere and turns it into chemicals that can be used in the production of greener and more sustainable products, including consumer personal products, cosmetics, furniture, and clothing. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really interested to find out a little bit more about Viridi CO2 and your journey to date. But I think maybe to start with, if you could tell us a little bit more about what Viridi CO2 actually does, a little bit about the technology and the problems that it's looking to solve, because I think it's such an interesting area you're working in.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you very much for having me along. It's a pleasure to be here. So Viridi CO2 ultimately was born from my PhD studies. I studied a PhD in catalysis in chemistry and really was tasked with coming up with a way of transforming carbon dioxide into anything useful.
Yeah.
As simple as that. And what I was able to find was a process which can be applied to the manufacturing of numerous products, some you mentioned already, that basically replaces the carbon within those materials with carbon directly from carbon dioxide. All these materials are traditionally made from carbon from fossil fuels.
Fossil fuel sources, the kind
Absolutely.
Of things that we're looking to get away from having
Exactly.
to use.
Crude oil, natural gas.
Yep.
Everything has carbon in it. It just so happens that sort of 80% of all of our consumer goods that everyone touches every single day, it comes from fossil fuels.
Yes.
And we have to solve that problem.
Yeah.
So our process ultimately enables the replacement of carbon from fossil fuel with carbon from carbon dioxide, which is obviously the waste of
many processes. Is another area we're trying to solve. So this is that dual aspect of not only are you replacing the current challenges we have with using fossil fuels, but you're replacing it with the very thing that we're looking to stop releasing into the atmosphere.
Absolutely.
So it's a win-win on either side. And as you say, I think it's such a broad technology when I look at it. It can be used to make so many things. We talk about these high-value chemicals that it can make. It can almost be difficult for people to understand what that means.
Mm-hmm.
But I look around me in the morning when I get up and it's like, well, if I'm going to go for a run, I pull on some leggings. They could have material in them that has been made using your technology and that's locking away
Indeed.
CO2 that would have otherwise been let off into the atmosphere. I can go for my run, come back, wash my hair, and the shampoo can have in, and the bottle that the shampoo's in, all of these things. I think it's such a broad-ranging technology that its uses are incredible, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's such an impressive technique.
Yeah, it's alarming in a way that most people don't understand where things come from.
Yeah.
And what is actually at the heart of them. When people think chemicals, you think of the horrible things that hide underneath your kitchen sink.
Yes.
Or that someone is using in a laboratory, hidden away in a university.
With a big skull and crossbones across
exactly
the front of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
And that's what people think chemicals are. And it's very much not the case. The chemical industry is the backbone of literally everything around us. There are chemicals in your phone. There are chemicals in your sofa. There are chemicals in your shoes. And they're transformed into products that we associate with everyday life. And people don't see that. And that is why the impact of manufacturing is so colossal when we talk about emissions. And that's why it's so hard to try and get to sustainable technologies, because we're so reliant upon all of these materials that ultimately come from fossil fuels and release thousands, millions, gigatons of CO2 in the production. And that's why it's so difficult for us to solve the sort of climate issues and manufacturing issues. But at the heart of it all is the chemical industry.
Yeah. And the life that we live is based around these things. So
indeed.
Finding a way to still live that life, but in a less damaging way.
Yeah.
Is solving, exactly where you come in.
Exactly. And really, solving climate change is actually fundamentally really easy. However, solving climate change and maintaining the luxuries in life that everyone is accustomed to
is the big challenge.
No one really wants to give up on driving their car because it is convenient. It gets you from A to B. It allows you to do whatever you would like to do in your life. However, everybody knows that if you stop driving your car, you're going to stop releasing CO2 emissions, if you have a petrol diesel, of course. However, persuading someone to do that is the hard bit. And that is where you are giving up what is a luxury in your life in order to really do the thing for the benefit of the human race on the planet. So that's the challenge. And that is the beauty, and I'm sure we'll go into this a little bit more, of our technology, where we can take a waste material and produce the materials that everyone uses around them, and they wouldn't even know they're doing it. In doing so, we reduce the fossil fuel reliance of a multitude of products
all
that
of the
they
things
use.
Whoever's listening now, look around you, you're going to see you're going to see 100 things that are reliant on fossil fuels.
There's further benefits. Like, we enable the chemical industry to do traditional processes at lower temperatures.
Okay.
So you've got to burn less fuel to make the energy to make the products. So you burn less fuels, which are fossil fuel based, and you release less CO2 as a result. So there's a multitude of benefits that we've come to learn about this technology beyond what it was just when
you started this first concept of, can I make something
anything
from
CO2?
Can I make anything useful from CO2?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's how some of the research starts, right? We know roughly what we want to do. Can we make something useful?
Can we make something useful? We'll see what comes from there. So I think, yes, we'll certainly, I'd be really interested to talk a little bit more about the technology, but it might be worth as well at this point, you've mentioned there your PhD as the starting point, but looking back, where you are now running a company with this huge opportunity to where you were then, talk me through how you went from, did you have an entrepreneurial aspiration at the time or before you started your PhD, or has this been a journey that has happened through fortunate happenstance?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think about that sometimes. Where did the kind of entrepreneur come from?
Yeah.
There's a funny story in my family that my mum took over a preschool.
Okay.
So my dad once said, I have no idea where this entrepreneurial trait has come from,
but maybe it was secretly in your genes all along.
Who knows? There could be a link there. But dialing back to sort of the journey that I've been very fortunate to have so far, I went to uni at Southampton studying chemistry. The reason I wanted to do chemistry was kind of twofold, I guess. There were two things I was good at school. It was maths and chemistry, and I didn't want to do a maths degree. And I really enjoyed, obviously, the practical side of chemistry.
Yes.
There's no getting away from that. And it was in my third year of my undergraduate degree that I sat in the lectures of Professor Robert Raja, my now co-founder, business partner. And Robert talked about sustainability.
Okay.
And how we can improve the chemical industry by developing more sustainable processes and touching on the kind of materials that everyone has in their home. So the production of nylon goes into carpets. Robert had a very big project in delivering more sustainable processes to deliver that. And he talked about it. And
okay.
I was like, that is the chemistry I want to do.
That is the type, the one that's going to do something.
Yeah. But we had no idea it was going to be focused on CO2. Yeah. And I decided I want to do a PhD with Robert. Mm-hmm. I would like to learn more, ultimately, be able to have an impact.
Yeah.
And I got towards the end of my degree. I actually went over to America. I lived there for 6 months doing an undergraduate project. And that was great fun. I came back. I sat Robert down in January and said, Robert, I want to do my PhD with you. And he told me I had missed the deadline.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So he had no money to be able to take me.
I feel like that might be the beginning of a fundraising story.
Maybe. So anyway, I left uni. I graduated with first class honors and I didn't apply to any jobs. I decided that I didn't really know what I wanted to do at that point. I think a lot of people in that situation, and there was certainly no want to go build businesses at that point. I ended up working in recruitment because a guy who I played cricket with collared me, sat me down, told me I should give it a go, and I did so.
Yeah.
I worked with him for 10 months, and I was okay, but I made sure I applied for that PhD with Robert 6 months early.
It maybe just firmed up that feeling where it's that this isn't the right place for me.
No.
It must have been quite a strong inkling, though, to go back.
Yeah, I always missed it. I found that I wasn't being challenged with the level of chemistry and scientific knowledge.
Yes.
Necessarily. I enjoyed aspects of the role, though. I did say when I left that I wouldn't be using any of the skills that I learned there ever again. And
oh,
man,
I bet you
that
regret
has,
that
has bit me. As I've now hired everyone in our company.
Yeah.
I've negotiated rates with recruiters. And parts of that job I miss, actually. Building relationships with people. The art of conversation and the negotiation. And actually, I never told my then boss, but I think some of my management skills have largely come from the way he managed me. And I keep in touch with him. We share LinkedIn exchanges from time to time. I think he didn't realize what me disappearing off to go do a PhD would turn into.
I'm not sure. Did you know at that point
absolutely
what it
not.
Would turn into?
The position started with an interview with Robert, even though I'd made it very clear that I very much wanted to do a PhD with him.
Yeah.
And he told me there was going to be no formal interview process, but you've got to go through the process. And really, I got asked, what do you want to focus on your PhD? I said, I would like to do something impactful. I don't want to do science for science sake.
Yeah.
And CO2 was the topic that came up. And I said, I want to do that.
So that was the trigger point. But even then, that desire for impact in a particular way that you'd identified as well, I think was clearly pulling you in a direction, even if you didn't know what that direction was at that point.
I think so. I've always grown up with the climate challenge. I remember very vividly being at school, watching Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. I don't know how old I was, 12, 13.
Uh-huh.
And that was clear. We've got a problem. And I sat in that science class going, someone will solve that. No problem. We know about it. The evidence is clear.
Yeah.
And then I get towards the beginning of my PhD and it's only getting worse.
And you work out that the person or one of those people is going to be you.
Yeah, yeah. But even at that point it was, I'd like to do some cool research. Didn't ever think that it would roll into where we are now. But going through the journey, the PhD was the time where we went from discovering the technology. So I invented it, proved it, and the goop, which is lovingly referred to in the company, was the very first validation that we'd converted carbon dioxide, gaseous gas form, CO2, into goop. And that goop, in theory, is actually the feedstock for polyurethanes.
Which is amazing goop.
Yeah. So polyurethanes.
I would say trademark it, but I think someone else has already got there first.
Well, we picked that reaction because it's the archetypal, what do you convert CO2 into kind of reaction. It's a reaction that ultimately can produce feedstocks that go into shoes. So polyurethanes, the soles of shoes, for example, or into loft insulation. So we're already touching on at that point the potential for impacting.
So you can
products.
Already see that you're taking waste, gas, CO2 that would otherwise go into the atmosphere and that almost everyone now will be like, that's bad. We don't want that there. And you have turned it into goop that isn't just goop.
Yeah.
It's shoes or it's insulation. And it's those processes were already in place as well that once you got to the goop, the next bit, people could do.
Yeah, very much so.
But you've locked away. I always envisage your technology now as effectively locking away that CO2, that it's little packages of it all just being gathered up and placed in my leggings or shampoo or whatever it is that
Indeed.
I happen to be doing. But when you saw that goop, did you have that feeling of this is going to be big?
No, I thought I was going to get a really good Nature paper.
Well, I mean, that is big. It is big in a different way.
Oh, big scientifically. I thought, oh, my academic career is set.
It
and I'm
is
only
golden.
6 months into a PhD.
Yes.
That was the thought process. Yeah. That was the thought process for the next 2 years, I'll be very honest. We had stumbled upon something that, in terms of the science itself, no one had really demonstrated under the benign conditions that we were able to demonstrate it. And I still have the draft of that paper that has not been sent because we chose a different strategy.
Chose a different route.
Which ultimately has brought us together.
Yes. Yes, you decided to go patent instead of paper at that
Indeed,
stage.
Indeed, there were a few steps before we came together. So 2 years in, about then, we had started to look into what the opportunity was. Why, if we've discovered this, there must be someone else in the world that is able to do something as well as us. And we looked into what was available and came to realize ultimately that we had a technology that was able to do a lot of things that the rest of the chemical industry could not do.
And as you say, it can do it benignly.
More benignly, yes. So lower pressures, lower temperatures. The difficulty with carbon dioxide is it's so stable. It is very happy staying as CO2, and trying to force it to convert into something else, we have to pour loads of energy into it. And that's the issue with CO2 utilization technologies. Mm-hmm. The way that we circumvent that problem is we designed a process which lowers the energy requirement to overcome the barrier. And that's ultimately what came out of my PhD, is a chemical process that activates the carbon dioxide towards interacting with other things. And we use other things to make products that go into consumer items.
No, I mean, it's really interesting, but you obviously had this, you looked around, thought, oh, actually, maybe we are the first people to do this. You still had that Nature paper sitting, I'm assuming.
Yeah, we at that point, I guess we started to think a bit more about what it could turn into, because scientific publishing isn't the only route to IP protection.
Indeed.
So we sat down with the university, discussed our options. We then decided that we would like to file a patent. So the university supported that decision. The next conversation that came from that was, we're paying quite a bit of money to protect the IP. What's the plan? Like,
what are you going to do with it?
We just spent thousands of pounds protecting your IP. How do we make our money back?
Yeah. Well, indeed, that's often the case with IP, isn't it? So the why are you filing this is an important question to ask. Otherwise, you could have just published it and someone else could have just done it without anything to do with you.
Exactly. And really, Rob and I had sort of sat down and discussed what is it we wanted to achieve. And when you discover a technology like this and you come to realize that if we get this right, we have the opportunity to significantly impact an industry which is unfortunately sort of pasted as being very dirty.
Has a bad rep.
It has a bad reputation. Yeah. But actually, the chemical industry is beautiful in that it is itself its own solution. It is always trying to iterate and is always trying to be cleaner. So Robert and I sort of had a pretty frank conversation of what is the best way to bring this to the world. Yeah. And unfortunately, scientific publication is not generally the fastest route. And the way to make something get to the world more quickly is ultimately to try and commercialize it and make it profitable. And that really was the turning point. That was where I changed from, I'd like to be an academic, which I think every PhD has that dream at some point, to the, I can't be an academic because I need to drive this.
Taking this out into the real world and it's going to happen.
Exactly that. And Robert gave me the opportunity to be the person to lead it. So he took a body of work which would obviously show his expertise in the area as well,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
And he said, run with it. And he's given me the opportunity, someone who has, at this point, no publications,
yep.
No business acumen, because I've not trained to be a businessman. I have no formal qualifications in really delivering a company as such. And he said, I trust you to take this technology and let's try and do it.
There's nothing like building the plane while you're flying it, is there?
And that was the point where I transitioned from wanting to be an academic to taking the jump.
To really. Taking that leap of faith. And it is a bit of a leap of faith, because it's a bit of a leap into the unknown at that point where you step off the edge. Looking back, sometimes you think, well, actually, that was probably the least problematic step of the 100 more steps that I took after that. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it's such a big step, I think, to step out of the planned route. So if your planned route is, I'm going to be an academic, you kind of know what that looks like. You're going to do your PhD, you're going to do a postdoc, you're going to do this. You know that route. You stepping out of that's a real step into the unknown.
Yeah.
Although you were saying to me that you have a bit of a mantra that you will always...
Give everything a go.
Give everything a go.
That's why I ended up in recruitment.
So it got you there, but it also, I assume, helped you take that step of once someone put it in your head, you're like, well, let's just give it a go and see where it takes us.
Yeah, I think so. And with that opportunity in your hands, I think it's harder almost to say no. It's scary, don't get me wrong. Yeah. There was a lot of sleepless nights in trying to decide that, but also appreciating my position, where I was in my career, where I was in my life, that made for easier decisions. For example, I don't have kids. I was renting, so I don't have a mortgage to pay. There are a lot of things that make that decision easier.
Slightly de-risked, but I think it depends on what people's viewpoints are.
Exactly.
Because other people are thinking, well, this is the very time I should be staying in the safe zone. I need to build my security. So I think you still had that moment where you took that,
yeah,
that risk.
I say so, and there's also an element of why not?
Exactly, why not? And if your mantra stays true, it's probably taken you down some very interesting roads.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it already has done.
And you never, at least that way, you never have any regrets.
Indeed.
Or at least they're active regrets. You chose it.
I think also, say we get to 2050, say we're very shortly burning to a crisp because of the climate, and I sit there and go, oh, I had that technology that I didn't commercialize or try and commercialize, and here we are. I think I would not be able to live with myself.
Yeah.
If I made that decision. Whereas at least right now, I can say I'm doing everything within my power to deliver a technology that I think is going to make a real impact to the world.
Yeah. And I think you can't underestimate that drive from you to take that forward, though, because even at that stage, a lot of people might have looked at it and said, we'll license this. That's going to be our route. I'm going to stay in the place I feel comfortable. And we'll just see if we can get someone else to take it on. But you took the brave route of, actually, I want to make sure this happens. And the way to make sure it happens is that I stay with it,
yeah,
and drive it forward. And I think that's really commendable and amazing.
Yeah, I think there's probably a bit of an ego play there as well. I won't lie. I think I'm the best person to do this, therefore I want to drive it. At that point, we also recognised there was still R&D to do.
Yes.
And it was my PhD project. I know all the ins and outs. I know
nobody knows it better than you.
Indeed. I feel that I knew exactly where it was weak. I knew where it was strong. And I was in the best place to be able to grow it. And that came into the decision making as well.
Fantastic. So you decided to spin out. Is that how it...
There was a few steps before that. So we decided we were going to do a company. And at that point, there was an opportunity to apply to some funding that was supported by Innovate UK. It was the iCure scheme, so innovation to commercialization of university research. In order to get that funding, I actually finished my PhD early.
Okay.
So I wrote up early and submitted in order to give me the bandwidth to be able to go full time onto this program. And it's a program of market research, ultimately. The beauty of it is you are getting market research under the guise of being a scientist, yeah, rather than being a salesman. And suddenly a lot more people want to talk to you when you've got a cool piece of technology you're trying to test
understand
out
how it fits in the
Indeed.
World. Yes.
Indeed. That was also supported by a fellowship award from the university. So they continued to support me, make sure I was salaried to be able to do this work, which was a great support.
Yeah.
And from that Innovate UK iCure scheme, we found that there was a huge calling for this type of technology, and we were able to make the case for a startup, and we won £300,000 of Innovate UK grant money.
Fantastic.
Equity free.
Oh, as a start point, that's really good.
Oh, absolutely.
Although I'm sure you were surprised at how quickly you could burn through it.
Yes. I was trying to think of some kind of way to say maybe not, but no. As a startup, you hire the people,
yeah,
in order to deliver the R&D. You want to deliver it as quickly as possible, so you do burn through cash. But with that grant, I was then able to leverage a further $500,000 of angel investment, and that's where we received further support from the university. We're very fortunate at Southampton University to have the Future Worlds Accelerator.
Yes.
And I got in there reasonably early. I remember going and pitching to them, taking my little balloon of CO2 and some of our goop and saying, I turn this into this. And they supported us from day one. We did a cohort, which actually went through COVID at this point.
Okay.
This is back in 2022 now.
Uh-huh.
I submitted during COVID. I did my Viva online. But the accelerator gave us training on how to pitch. what's the business model, and really the core basics of being an entrepreneur that as a scientist you just don't know.
Well, why would you have been really exposed to that to exactly. the level that you're required? So
yeah, they gave us that exposure. They critiqued us and made us able to go and stand in front of a group of investors. And they did that. They brought together a whole room of investors and we pitched as part of Demo Day. And that brought me my angel investors.
Yep.
So we closed out and SPAN officially in November 21. Sorry, it was 2020, the COVID years that I was doing my PhD. But ultimately we SPAN out and that was, we're here.
Yeah.
We are our own identity. We have just under £1 million to have a go.
take your goop making technology
yeah.
and show that it can scale, I guess, is
ultimately.
The challenge at that point, that it, you know, the real world problems that we've been talking about. And how is that going?
Yeah. Well, that was really the beginning of the company, even though it was built upon at that point 5 years of
yes.
of research. And it was just three of us at that point. And ultimately, we went out to prove that we could scale our process.
Yeah.
That was the key thing we needed to do. Typically, chemicals are really hard to get beyond grams in the lab. And we set ourselves the challenge of, with that UK government money and the angel support, to get it to kilos.
Mm-hmm.
And then with that, find someone who would like to trial it.
Yes.
And we set ourselves 12 months to achieve that. We achieved it in 9, and we had 2 people who wanted to trial it.
Fantastic.
And with that traction, brought EQT to the table. So huge tier 1 investor. We got the connections again through Future Worlds. The partner who set up the Venture 3 fund, the co-founder of that fund, is ex-Southampton. So was involved with Future Worlds. And I pestered him for 3 months. Ali, you're going to want to give me some money.
See, this is where that 10 minutes you spent in the recruitment is coming in handy.
Maybe
that's
where it came from.
A level of persistence.
Persistence, yeah. Resilience, persistence. And I joked with him for 12 months of, Ali, you're going to want to give me some money. Yeah. You are not going to want to miss out on this. And he tasked me with coming and bringing an LOI as such to prove that commercial interest. And off the back of the project, we had 2. So I said to Ali, I've got 2 of those that you wanted. Can we have a chat? And a few months later, EQT invested $3 million into Viridi. That was
Excellent.
February 23. And that was a real step change at that point. We were only 5 or 6. So
yeah.
we managed to do a little bit of hiring with the angel money. And then that is what has accelerated us to where we are now.
So rounding out the team and...
Indeed. And we're 16 now. So that was a real turning point. And that was, when you take VC money, things get serious.
Yes.
And you're committing to delivering, ultimately, within the timelines of their fund. And they're a fantastic partner. And they have accelerated us in a whole number of ways that I never thought we could go faster in. And that's the kind of investor you want. And they're amazing.
The right type of pressure.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And making you understand the things that are, as a scientist, in your blind spots, because you haven't been brought up on business. Even though I try and read all the books. And that really brings us to where we are now. Having grown the company to 16, we have bespoke labs at the University of Southampton. We have scaled and validated our manufacturing process to multi-kilogram quantities. And we are very soon to be signing our first scale-up and offtake agreements.
Which is incredible. So where next? Once you get that, what's the next stage for Viridi? Have you looked ahead and thought, actually, after we do this, the next stage is, do you know where that's going?
Yeah. We ultimately want to be growing into every chemical manufacturing process that is capable of delivering the types of products that we can ultimately affect. So we have early traction in a number of these products that we've mentioned, primarily in surfactants, so cleaning ingredients. That's where we're focusing right now. We've got trials all around the world. On all of the major manufacturing continents, we are putting our technology, which to the layman, we make a white powder, right?
It's a very clever white powder, I can confirm.
It's a catalyst. It's part of a chemical process that enables the use of this CO2. It's what activates the carbon dioxide. And we go to people's sites and we watch them put our powder into their existing processes. So no one has to build a new plant to adopt us. You put it into their big steel drum, which is a big chemical reactor. And suddenly you open up this world of being able to use CO2 as a feedstock. And so our journey over the next certainly 2 or 3 years is about growing that scale and our impact.
So you're looking for anywhere at the moment that is using a fossil fuel feedstock and saying, we could replace this.
Yes,
with
ultimately.
Either their own CO2, I guess this can be circular, the CO2 that they're doing, or you could you use waste stored CO2? I know there's a lot of storage of CO2 around. I don't know if that's something or...
So CO2 is rather easy to get our hands on. Most chemical manufacturing sites, which is who our customers are, the chemical manufacturers of the world who make the ingredients that you would never see, but get transformed into your consumer products, they all have energy production on site, whether that be natural gas boilers or coal boilers. So they're producing CO2. And therefore, we can tap into that.
You can just
as
use that.
A source.
Yeah.
And that can be literally pumped from their boiler across, cleaned up a little bit, and dropped into the reactor. Now, that previously was just waste.
Yeah.
And at some point in time, actually, it's going to cost them as carbon credits.
Yes.
Now, if you change the narrative and say, actually, you can take that as a feedstock material. So the previous fossil fuel feedstock, which costs thousands of US dollars per ton, we can replace up to 50% of that directly with carbon dioxide. So you've just reduced your bill on that front by close enough 50% because your CO2 is nearly free. You have to include your cleaning costs. But it's tens of dollars versus thousands. So there's a huge cost-saving aspect here. And then you run your process at a cooler temperature. You're able to reduce the fuel required to drive the process. And there are a few other cool nuances to our technology that remove process steps. So all in all, this is a green technology, but it's a green technology that saves money.
It's a green technology that's commercially viable.
Indeed.
I think is the key here. It's, you know, it's a win-win.
There's no green premium.
Yeah.
We have the opportunity to save manufacturers up to 30% in their costs.
Mm-hmm. And you can do this at scale. You've said you've proven now that this isn't just a benchtop technology, which is often the challenge that people start with. This is something that can be done at the scales they need to do it. Mm-hmm. So certainly if anyone is listening, get in touch.
Indeed. But it's, the next 2 to 3 years are probably going to be the most exciting.
The big ones for pushing everything forward. So how do you ensure that your solution is going to remain scalable? Do you need to do anything more, or is that...
We're always iterating aspects of the technology that can be improved upon. And there's a whole range of things in how efficiently we can manufacture it, the costs associated with the manufacturing of it, how much we need to use in order to transform the CO2, how well does it integrate with existing infrastructure, how many products can it make? So there's a number of these things that we focus on in order to ensure scalability of our product. And from a very sort of business perspective, the revenue and the profits ultimately that we can derive for a business, because we have to think about that aspect.
Yeah.
We are saving the planet, but we're running a business at the same time. So yes, we always have to keep iterating. We have to make sure that we are providing the best solution in future, not just now.
And I think that's right, though, when you're saying there, you've got to think about these things. So, I mean, we're a B Corp, something, and it is one of the tenets they look at, is that it's profit with purpose. Mm-hmm. But you still need to be profitable in order for it to keep going. Mm-hmm. Something can be great, but if fundamentally it's not commercially viable, it's not going to get taken up. It's not going to be this solution that you've been talking about where people can actually take it up and not feel too much additional pain, or any in this case, from what I can tell, that this is a one where if they're willing to take a look at it, it's a win-win for everyone involved.
Indeed. But it is the sad part of technology. And the bit that I have to live with is ultimately we're trying to build a business that makes profit, as you say. And as long as we are able to deliver the purpose, then I think that is fine. That's how we should be operating.
Yeah.
But it is sad that there are an awful lot of very good technologies which could have tremendous impact that simply aren't profitable. And therefore, they are never going to reach the scales that
deliver.
Or
they're not profitable yet.
The art of innovation and the people who support the innovation is trying to pick the ones that do.
Yes. Right?
And that's hard. Ultimately, though, for a technology to be able to have global impact because of the sheer quantum of the problem that we're facing, it has to be a profitable business. And we knew that when we started the company, right?
Yeah. It needs to be profitable at scale. And it's just occasionally you'll see businesses who have a really good idea and they need to be supported through to the point of scale. I think from everything you've said, you've actually had a really good support network around you.
Yeah, very much so.
Which has helped move you to a point now where you can start to evidence this scale. But I still applaud you for all the effort that it's taken you to get there. Viridi CO2 is going to make a huge impact. I really believe that. But we're going to need others. So for the people who are following behind you, are there any things that they should be thinking about? What would you recommend if there's someone listening thinking, I think I could do that? What would you recommend that they start to do? Is it, you know, is it people they should meet? Is it exposure to different things? Is it going to join something like Future Worlds? What is it you think would be the best advice you could give them at this stage?
I think it's about gathering as much knowledge. You have to make decisions based on data. The more data you can gather, the better your decision making. So ultimately, from my perspective, coming from the science is obvious. Of course this is going to work. I'm the scientist that invented it. But what I didn't understand was the unit economics. How do you go and get support to gather data from people who are competent in the field in areas that you're not? And there is an element that you have to be able to sit and listen to why you're not very good. Why is your technology not the problem? The Innovate UK IQ scheme that I mentioned, we talked a lot about not going and finding people who like you or like your technology. It's about finding why people don't like your technology. What is the barrier? And that is all data to be able to inform you what your journey could look like in delivering it. So I think the most important thing is find people who are knowledgeable. And people are usually very good. They are very willing to give up their time and share nuggets. But you will have to go through a lot of people to filter through to find the small bits of really amazing information. And when you find those people, you bring them onto your board.
You keep them.
But I think the most important thing in the early stages, get as much information as you can.
Yeah.
And understand the impact of it for your technology. You have to be able to make this a commercial opportunity if you're going to be delivering ultimately a business that remains a going concern. You don't have to know, in my opinion, the ins and outs of running a business. You bring in very competent professionals to handle those things for you. So as we're here on IP, for example, but accountants and stuff like
that.
But you need to be able to know the basics enough to be credible and to be able to make important decisions. And beyond that, it's just then building the team to deliver.
Yeah, just like that.
Easy,
it's interesting, yes. It's interesting because one of our mantras is that we work with clients to enable them to make the best IP decisions, because I think it is a case of, and everyone I've spoken to so far talks about building a team around them, but you still, as the CEO, need to have enough knowledge. So you need to bring a team together who can enable you to confidently make decisions without drowning you in the volume of data and information. So getting the right information to you to make those decisions. Do you miss the bench work? Do you get to do any?
I am quite often referred to as a pest in the lab.
The best type. You can come in, dabble, and leave.
I will always be the first person, and I hope that everyone in the company would agree with me, that if something needs to be done, needs to stay late, needs to work a weekend, whatever, I'll be the first person to say, I volunteer to help out with whatever it is. Quite simply, I'm not the best scientist anymore. There was a time where I was the most knowledgeable person on our technology, and I am not anymore. And that is the way it should be. I have hired better scientists than I, and they are far more competent at delivering the technical goals than I will ever be. And for that reason, I have no reason to step back into the lab, but I will happily be a spare pair of hands to enable them to do the best work they can. Do I miss it? I think part of me misses it for a very short period of time, and then I go do something in the lab and it doesn't work, and then I remember why I don't necessarily want to be back in the lab again.
Sounds like why we became patent attorneys. It's quite nice. We only get to hear the good things, the bits that work.
Yeah, but I guess in a way the thing that I don't get is I don't get that first-hand personal touch on when things do go well.
On the goop.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't get to realize that celebration in person. And I love seeing my team when they solve the problem and you see it on their face, like, I've contributed, I've nailed the problem.
Yeah.
And that for me then is secondhand. I get to see that and I enjoy that, but I don't get to relish in that. And I guess one of the downsides of being the CEO is your job is not to enjoy the good times, it's to go problem solve. And so really your job is staring into the void of problems. And you spend all of your time problem solving. And you can spend days, months, years solving problems. You don't spend days, years enjoying
the celebration. Yeah.
The celebration is momentary, and then you flip back to, right, what's the next problem? And as the CEO, you get rolled into the biggest problems. And so you're always – there was a line I saw to describe this of what being a CEO is, and it's staring into the void and chewing glass. And it's right. You have a level of certainty around your business, but it's not concrete.
Yep.
So you're staring into the void and you're always dealing with problems. So you're chewing glass.
Well, hopefully you've got some people occasionally around you.
Oh, absolutely. We get told to celebrate.
Allow you to see a flash of light in that void every so often.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't view it quite like that. I've just found it an interesting
way of describing it. You seem far too positive to be truly staring into the void and not seeing something.
I get to wake up every single day knowing that we are pushing the boundaries of chemical manufacturing to make for a better world tomorrow.
Yeah. And it's looking positive.
It's looking incredible. I've been gifted with this opportunity. I've hired everyone in my team. We are resolute in what we're trying to deliver. And quite simply, if we, as an industry, if we don't solve this, we're in a lot of trouble globally. Everyone's impacted. There's not a single person on the planet that doesn't get affected by the climate, which is ultimately what we're trying to influence.
If you're putting a shout out to other entrepreneurs out there, what do you think they should be doing? So you're solving CO2. What do you think they should be solving? What are the other big ones out there that either it's going to be your next one when you finish this, or you're hoping someone else is out there being a version of you doing the same thing?
I think that's impossible to answer. So I'm going to change it slightly. I can't pinpoint another world crisis that I think is more of a priority than others. Like world hunger. Like everyone would like to see that solved. I don't have the answers. I know that it's a very complex scenario to solve these things, and it is inappropriate of me to pick one. What I can say, though, is for someone who wants to be an entrepreneur or is dabbling with the idea of being an entrepreneur, they need to find something that they feel is their purpose and to be 100% behind it. And that is so important because it's really hard. This journey is the toughest thing that you're going to do, quite simply. You can bring around the best people to support you, but if you are leading and founding a frontier technology, it's a very lonely road. The decisions you've got to make sit with you if you're the CEO, and you make those with the best data you have, but you're calling the shot. And the entire business relies on that decision. And so if you are not driven by your purpose, suddenly you can question why you're doing it. And there's no question for me. I can see exactly the impact we're going to have. And I am resolute in my belief that we're going to play a pivotal role in transforming the chemical manufacturing industry to make consumer products more sustainable for everyone. Even though no one's going to know that surfactant, that cleaning thing, came to the supermarket shelf using our technology.
I'll know.
We hope to get a stamp on there somehow. But
Coop inside,
Even when we're having the worst day, the worst week, everything is going wrong, I get out of bed and I love my job because I have purpose. And I worry that if someone just tries to pick a problem and they haven't necessarily got the drive all the time, you can then find yourself in a position where you're not as effective as you want to be, and you're not solving the problem at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So That's how I would frame
that. So maybe that's a, it's more a find your purpose.
Indeed. And that then comes from how your life has evolved. People get into certain healthcare because mm-hmm. they've seen a loved one
yeah.
who suffered. I happened to watch Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth at age 13 and thought someone's going to solve that problem, and then no one did.
No one did, and you,
and
you found yourself, yeah.
So
picking up the, yeah.
Yeah, so that's how I would view it. People have got to want something so much and want to deliver on it that they
They're
can drag
to
themselves.
Those steps,
yeah.
That step forward every day.
Someone who can chew glass every day.
And stare into,
stare
the,
into
void.
The void. Knowing that they are going to deliver impact to the world.
Yeah. That it's worth it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I think that's great. Well, I think that probably wraps everything up today. So I guess the final thing is that where could our listeners go if they wanted to find out a little bit more about you and Vridi CO2? Is there somewhere you'd point them to?
Yeah, we're very fortunate that we've had coverage all the way through our journey.
Yeah.
So if you look for us, you'll find a website, obviously. There's a few cool videos on there. There's some things on YouTube. Actually, so Future Worlds presented a mini docu-series.
Yep.
We have an episode in there, and they've done a fabulous job of that. And we've also got our socials, LinkedIn primarily. We like to keep people up to date.
Fantastic.
So they're the main areas you can find us.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much. That's been a really great chat.
No, thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Defining the Future. For any information on what we've covered in this episode, head to the show notes. It would be great if you could rate and leave a review for the podcast. Subscribe to the show so you don't miss out on future episodes.